Welcome to the 251st edition of Europe Calling. I would like to extend a very special welcome to our four interesting guests and the more than 2,000 people registered from all over Europe. Wonderful. Today's topic is European security and defense. Thanks very much, Hannah Neumann. Thank you and her team for helping us to put this together. So today's webinar is here to explore two questions. What are the major gaps in Europe's security and defense policy, and how can we close those gaps? And the second issue is how can this be done transparently and with democratic control? So we have fantastic guests, Gabriele Landsbergis, Laetitia Seydoux, Camille Grain, and Hannah Neumann. They're very different perspectives on this issue, not least because they bring with them perspective from the Baltic states, from Germany, France, Belgium, and the EU institutions' perspectives, and they're often carrying several hats at the same time. So before we begin, just a few quick announcements, a little housekeeping. We'll be mainly speaking English today. If you need assistance, we have our two wonderful interpreters, and you can select the language bar under the small globe in the control bar.
Just repeating, this is in English, but you won't need it anymore because for the next 30 seconds, I'm going to speak German and then switch into English. But if you still want to listen to me, to my German, and need help with that, you can also switch in the interpretation to English on the little control panel. Then, wie immer, bei Europe Calling könnt ihr eure Fragen stellen und die Fragen
You
gerne
can ask questions
einfügen.
and evaluate questions of others.
Stellt dort
We're
gerne eure
using
Fragen,
Slido.
bietet die Fragen an,
Do use
schreibt es in
it.
den Chat und dann
The link will be in the
schaue ich mir
chat.
an,
And
wenn
as
Hannah
we
und
have
Gabriele dann
2,000
das
people who've
Panel
registered, we'll see which
dann
questions seem to be
sind wir bereit,
of
die
most
Fragen dann
interest.
dazu
And also, let me ask you
dann auch
to give us your name, because, you know, if I just have to say anonymous
anonymisieren.
user,
Und wie
it's
immer
not as
wird das
nice.
dann aufgezeichnet
So,
und
this will
dann
be
haben wir die Möglichkeit,
recorded and
später
a
auch zu
podcast will be
diskutieren.
created. Just to bear this in mind
Ja,
when you're
danke
asking
für die
questions.
Einladung.
That's all for the in.
And thus, I'm switching to English to introduce our first speaker. Hannah Neumann is a member of the European Parliament for the German Green Party. She is the Foreign Affairs and Defense Policy Spokesperson and Coordinator of the Committee on Foreign Affairs for the Greens EFR Group. She holds a doctorate in Politics and Peace and Conflict Studies from the Free University Berlin in collaboration with the University of Liberia and Notre Dame University Cotabato on the Philippines. And Hannah and her team helped to organize this webinar today. So thank you so much that we're doing this together, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Maximilian, for the amazing introduction. And first of all, I mean, thank you for Europe Calling, for always making these broad webinars possible where we talk about European issues. And I have to say, I'm quite impressed that there are about, I think right now, 800 to 900 people locked in that really want to discuss European defense. And I'm also very happy that I see some old friendly faces that are now in different institutions, but that are also discussing this with us tonight. As I have the privilege of having, let's say, the first inputs, I will touch upon your questions, but because I know that in the audience there are quite a lot of people who are not doing 24/7 defense policy, also take maybe two steps back before I do that. I mean, when I became a member of parliament 6 or 7 years ago, actually, I thought my mission would be, for example, to see how we can work on export control so that less weapons of Europe end up somewhere in the world, or how we can work on a nuclear disarmament and all of these issues. And what I think that is still very important to do, kind of the world around us has changed, and it forced us, also as Greens, to change our approaches and policies on defense. Without a total overhaul. And I think that's until today, the kind of the path we are trying to walk. Europe and the situation of Europe has dramatically changed, not only since the latest Russian invasion into Ukraine, but maybe most brutally by the Russian invasion into Ukraine. But if you ask me what are the main things that have changed, let's say, compared to 10 years ago, I would say number one, Europe is clearly no longer surrounded by friends, and this is most visible by Russia invading Ukraine and also clearly attacking us rapidly. But also the transatlantic reliance has become unpredictable, and I think that's even a euphemism. We just heard Donald Trump randomly attacking Greenland and announcing that he's going to invade it, which within a military alliance that has been built to protect yourselves against the outside is quite a weird way of interacting. And he has been unreliable all throughout. And we also see with his migration discourse or attacks on European legislation, for example, on the Digital Services Act and others, that we cannot rely, at least on the US, as a strong partner in NATO. So that's the second thing that has changed. And I would also say that we are, especially again since the Russian invasion into Ukraine, but we already saw that building up before, looking at new forms of warfare. So the kind of hybrid warfare that we see, at least the increase of it, is something that we haven't been prepared to well. We are talking about drones that have innovation cycles that clearly our traditional infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, cannot deal with at the moment. And we see cyber that has been turned into a battlefield, and some people say space is going to be next. But that's also something where we clearly need to step up. This is a bit of a sober outlook, I know. I'm also not very happy about it. I would also have liked to work on different things politically, but the only option we have in Europe is to step up, to deal with it, and to find answers to it. And the key goal, at least for me as a politician, is to keep Europeans and our closest allies safe. That is kind of my goal in this very difficult context to do that, or let's say the guiding principle. Three things we have to do in this regard, and I'm sure the colleagues that will come after me will expand even more. One is to respond to the challenges that we have out there. And that's why, by the way, I actually thought expanding the percentages on military spending to include 1.5 to work more on the broader aspects of security, including preparedness and others, was a smart thing, because that's also something like this holistic approach to security is clearly something that we need to step up. The second one is ensure that Europe can secure the security of Europeans and our closest allies, namely Ukraine, on its own if need be. I still think we would be much better off working together with the US, but if need be, we have to be on our own. And here clearly we are looking at capability gaps that we have painfully been made aware of by Donald Trump in the last year. I'm just going to name a few: air defense. We can't secure our airspace on our own. Satellite, especially military intelligence. And in the cyber domain. These are some of the key problems that we have where we rely on the US, and at the moment we cannot protect and defend ourselves. And the third point, and in times of budgetary constraint, that is also very crucial, we have to do so in the most cost-efficient way. We can do that by building synergies, especially within Europe, by working together, not procuring everything in competition, but jointly, by producing things together and not two or three or four times, but also by increasing control and transparency of the defense industry, I would say. What has become quite clear is that I think the best answer to make America great again or to the Russian aggression is Europe united. And by Europe united, I mean Europe and Ukraine united. The problem is, whilst I'm just describing to you how the situation has changed in the last 10 years and how much of a challenge that is, budgetarily, politically, but also politically, we are still discussing the very same things that we have discussed 10 years ago. So everything that I told you now, we knew it 10 years ago. We need to work together. We need to close these capability gaps. It needs to be European, not national. Why do we have all that competition? None of that is new, and I'm sometimes very frustrated, I have to tell you, in the European Parliament, that we continue having this discussion whilst urgency is just increasing. Nevertheless, I would say the last 10 years have seen a number of initiatives on the European level, and we work a lot with acronyms, so I'm going to throw some acronyms at you. I'm trying to solve some of them, but don't mind if you don't know all of them. That's all fine. So the first one is PESCO. I think that's how it started. It's called Permanent Structured Cooperation, which means that at least member states are starting to exchange data and do some projects together. Then maybe one of the more meaningful in recent years has been EDIP, European Defence Industrial Programme, where we are really not just thinking of national defence industries, but how we can work on that with a more European approach. Then there was SAFE, maybe some have heard. So it's basically not joint borrowing, but it's borrowing to lower interest rates for a lot of EU member states. And maybe the last one was the White Book or the Readiness 2030, where we identified these capability gaps, like where we are not good in Europe and where we need to become better. So I would even, and all of that is kind of mirrored or partnered by national initiatives. In Germany, you know, the Sondervermögen, so we have this extra money to buy more things. So there are things ongoing, but there are still a lot of problems remaining. And I want to touch maybe on five to kickstart the discussion before handing over to my colleagues. So problems that I see at the moment. The first one, I don't think everybody has fully understood yet that we need a holistic approach to security. So there are the defense people that are buying and developing all these things. And then we have the national level, and sometimes we have the county level, and then we have the community level, and then we don't even know if it's civilian or military, to work on the preparedness. Like, how do we make sure, for example, that our local infrastructure is not being hacked? Which, if it happens, kills everything. You can't get birth certificates, you can't get passports, you can't go to holidays, you can't marry. That's what, for example, some communities in North Rhine-Westphalia have just experienced. But also these drone attacks over airports. So here, clearly, we are not very well prepared because we don't have this holistic perspective on security yet. And also European Union can give strategies and make proposals, but then member states or the county level or the community level, because that's different everywhere, need to pick it up. And I'm afraid that's a bit too slow and too complicated in terms of giving a proper response to the threat, especially, but not only coming from Russia. The second one is that many people or many EU member states still see defense as a purely national thing. And they are willing to cooperate, I would say, binationally, trinationally, but not really Europeanize things. So giving competences to the European level. And just to give you two examples that I found very painful in recent months, the first one was the SAFE proposal. I told you where basically we are borrowing to joint interest rates. And the idea is that if these countries get these special European interest rates, they would also have to procure together. So to buy equipment together, because if you buy equipment together, that's cheaper. But then member states went to the negotiations and they negotiated for a sunset clause, which means that in the first 6 months that they put projects forward, joint procurement is even joint procurement when only one member state is buying something. So they were basically just mocking the whole idea and just sending this message of, we are happy to take your money, but leave us alone with your ideas and rules and European approaches. And that's something very frustrating. We also have the Future Combat Air System. Maybe Camille wants to say a bit more about that as well, where I think for more than a decade now, the French and the Germans are trying to develop a fighter plane. Basically, it's a total combat system together. And they are really negotiating with legal teams over every screw. That's not how it's going to work. But that's because it's two member states doing the negotiations and because it's not a truly European project. Third problem for me is the issue of transparency. I know that there need to be some secrets around military things. But we need, I think, to find a better balance between this need for secrecy, but also transparency. Here, for me, the example is the European Peace Facility. That is how, in the beginning, European member states have put money together to buy equipment to then give it to Ukraine. But no one had access from the parliamentary side, neither the European Parliament nor the national parliaments. We tried it from both ways to understand how these 8 billion euros were used, which is what left the door wide open for disinformation. So there were people saying, you know, it's the Germans that they make a lot of money with it. And then there were other people who were saying the Eastern Europeans are just getting rid of their very old equipment and making a lot of money with it. And in the end, the whole thing was dead because everybody thought they had the worst deal, but nobody could check what is actually true. So here, if we don't increase transparency in a situation where we put a lot of money in, I also think we risk losing losing out on the potential that is there. Point number four, a fair discussion between the arms industry and politics, because every money that goes into procurement, into buying defense equipment, is taxpayers' money. So if somebody pays a lot of money to get a super nice car from his private pocket, I'm totally fine if they pay a lot of money and the car manufacturer makes a lot of money. All good. When we talk about defense equipment, that is taxpayers' money. And my job is to make sure that we get the most security for the money of the citizens. And if I see arms industry making much, much more benefits than before the war, I get itchy. I'm fine with arms industry making some money, but we need to see that it stays fair. And I would hope that we can have a better discussion with the arms industry on how we can make it stay fair. But if that's not the case, I think we will have to discuss access benefits, because I'm not willing to put taxpayers' money basically into shareholder benefits. I don't think that's my role, and I don't think that's suitable, and I don't think we will get safer with that. And we will lose the understanding and the support of citizens, I think, for what we have to do defense-wise. And then the last point, we have to increase defense production capabilities right now. This is very painful for me to say as a Green, but that's the reality. At the same time, I hope that we will then not have to stay at these production levels for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, because hopefully we will find a solution to both problems, our transatlantic problem, as well as the Russian aggression in Ukraine. And then we need the defense industry to scale down again, because otherwise we run into a circle where we are kind of forced to export, which means create wars elsewhere. And I want us to think and build this into the system already right now. Maybe so much to kickstart the discussion, and I'm looking forward to what the others are going to share.
Well, thank you so much. Really fantastic introduction. I took a lot of notes, so ready to write the paper on that, I guess. So no, thank you so much. I think it painted very well the picture what this is about and what the challenges might be that we want to discuss. And for our next speaker, I think there are also a lot of bullet points that he will take up. And it's Camille Grant. He is, since September 2025, the Secretary General of ASD Europe, the Aerospace Security and Defense Industry Association for Europe. And he is an Associate Professor at the Paris School of International Affairs. And previously, he was Distinguished Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and Assistant Secretary General for Defense Investment at NATO. He also served in many other roles, including for the United Nations, the European Union, NATO, and the French government. So, Camille, I think you've seen it all, and great to have you.
Maximilian, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to join such a nice group of friends and colleagues, and to be able to discuss this really important issue for Europe, not only for the security of Europe or for defense industry, but for Europe altogether. I, as you mentioned, I come from a background both in academia and in public service. I've been with the defense industry for a few months, and I must say that it is a very interesting moment to do this and to look at how things move and how we can get this right. And I think a number of challenges that Anna highlighted are on the mind of the industry as well as on the mind of the politicians and the public. So I think it's really good that we are having this conversation. Looking at the substance, maybe a couple of things. First of all, and Anna covered it extremely well, so I don't need to go deeper, but we have to recognize that we are in an unprecedented geopolitical situation. This is something that we've said, many of us, many, many times, both in the politicians, in the think tank community. You know, there is this idea that there has been so many wake-up calls that it becomes a bit like the snooze button on an alarm clock. The reality is that we are in a different world than the world we at least I grew up in, and most of us grew up in, meaning that there is a war in Europe. Let's call it by its name. It's very clear, and I think most Europeans perfectly understand this. When I was at ECFR, we were doing polling of European publics, and I think there is a very broad recognition, including in parts of Europe that are less affected by the conflict in Ukraine. But this war is the largest war on the European continent since 1945. There was just a study by the Center for Security and International Studies in Washington that compiled data on casualties. This war has killed or injured 1.8 million people in the last 4 years. 1.2 million being Russians and roughly 600,000 being Ukrainian. So this is the best estimate I've seen, but it shows that the size and magnitude of this war, which in terms of the brutality of the fighting, the daily casualties only compares with the world wars. So this is really something that we have to fully understand and fully grasp. It is not a regional conflict on the margins of Europe. It's really something that is completely there. The second element is that we do see the rise of a global geopolitical competition, where, as many have said, might makes right, where we have the feeling that there are the use of force or the threat of the use of force is becoming a bit of a standard thing. And in that environment, Europe finds itself in an embarrassing situation of being the part of the world that, and that was a good news, was the most wedded to the rule-based international order, to the idea that peace through commerce or law was the right way forward. But now we end up, as the image goes, a bit like herbivores in a world of carnivores, and we have to really get that to sink in, because we're not going to have convince Putin to give up his imperial dreams by trade and just nice talks. We really have to look at this from a different perspective, and this is something that it goes beyond Russia, and we see that major powers, China, the United States, also use force more freely, and this idea that was very present, for instance, in the 2003 European Security Strategy, that Europe was surrounded by a ring of peace, is simply no longer true. Whether you look at the Middle East, at Africa, or of course at the post-Soviet space. If we add to this the US uncertainties, and uncertainties is a mild world, we are in a very, very different environment. You know, there has been in the past disputes with the Americans over major international affairs. You know, you take Iraq 2003, where France, Germany, and a few others opposed the invasion of Iraq. But that was about issues that were not core European security. Now we have a situation where there is a clear disagreement on the handling of Ukraine. The past 6 months has been a story of trying to convince the Trump administration to not throw Ukraine under the bus, and Europeans being more and more pressured to be responsible for that. But now we've seen with the Greenland thing, a situation where the US is in fact going against one ally and going after one ally, and is claiming the territory of that is under the control of Denmark. So it is a very, very unprecedented situation. Hopefully things in Davos were a bit put to rest, but there is no reason to believe that this has completely disappeared, and there is a non-zero chance that this crisis will resurface in the coming weeks or months. Mette Frederiksen, the Danish Prime Minister, was in Paris today, and she was absolutely crystal clear on the fact that for her, the issue was not resolved, and that she was concerned about the future. So bottom line is that none of this will disappear. The Europeans are indeed very much on their own, and we face a sort of situation where we do need to rearm, to be clear. That need has been fairly clear for a few years, but it's today even more clearer because Russia is not going to turn into a friendly neighbor anytime soon. Whatever is the outcome and the ceasefire settlement in Ukraine, if there is any, and the United States is going to be at best less interested in Europe, expecting the Europeans to do more, and possibly really turning its back on Europe or becoming hostile or adversarial on a certain number of issues, even if we can hope for the best relationship on that. So I think it's really important to state all of this because the key is to say that this is happening, this effort to invest in defense is not happening to please Donald Trump or to please the military industrial lobby or whatever. It is really about addressing security concerns and in a very new and unprecedented security situation. So that has led NATO to do two things. One in 2014 to decide to move to 2% of GDP on defense, which was for a number of countries already a challenge. At the time, amongst NATO allies, there were only three countries that were at 2%, the US, Greece, and the UK. And in light of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine and also of the US signaling that the Europeans needed to do more, the decision taken at the Hague summit in 2025 was to move that goalpost from 2%, which was more or less achieved by most allies, to 3.5% of GDP on defense, plus 1.5% on other related issues. So it's really a big change. In that context, I think there are a few important points. Those numbers look very impressive. In many cases, it means doubling or quasi-tripling the defense budget. But those are bringing us back to Cold War average. So it's not an arms race in the sense of going North Korean or Russian. Second, it's happening also because we are paying for 20 years of peace dividends. The defense budget across Europe in most countries did shrink very, very, very much. And now there is a lot of building back what was put at risk by those efforts. And ultimately, we need to do multiple things at the same time. So we need to help Ukraine. We need to rebuild our military to the right level of readiness. And we also need to innovate to prepare the future to not be too dependent on others. So all of this is not about preparing for a war. In fact, it is all about preventing a war, because the key issue of all of this is to convince potential adversaries that Europe is capable of defending itself and that it's no need to test our borders, whether it's in the Baltic region, in the Black Sea, or in the High North. And this is something that we really need to make sure that Putin fully understands. And second, this is also about reducing the dependencies on the US. So all of this, and I'll wrap up with a few points to say that there is some good news in that context. The first thing is the sort of yes, we can to paraphrase President Obama. The current budget's allowed to move that. European industry can deliver on multiple fronts. We do master 98% of the technologies needed for our security, and the EU toolbox is being increasingly mobilized. But I will flag, as Anna did, a few challenges for the conversation. The first one is we do need long-term support by the public. This needs to last probably for a decade, so this won't disappear overnight. And for that, from that perspective, it's extremely important to have a good public support and understanding. Second, there is a fiscal challenge across Europe that needs to be met. There are countries that are struggling to meet that objective because they simply struggle with their public budgets. Thirdly, there is a renationalization of procurement policies. A lot of countries, because they have money at home, don't think European, and we need to try to address that and to have a shared European perspective. And finally, for industry, there is a big effort about scaling up. What does that mean, and how do we eventually not so much scale down, but also manage hopefully a world in a few years from now where this growth in defense capability in grid defense industry is also managed to, and there are smart ideas also to not only being capable of producing, but not necessarily producing permanently at the level that we need to produce. So I'll leave it at that, and very, very much look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. Also very, very comprehensive and very well on time. Just so you notice when I switch off the spotlight and we all become small again, this is usually when it's a bit over time. So this is kind of a visual warning, but all very well. And thank you very much. We already have a lot of questions, more than 60 already. So please do check out the questions in the Slido. Maybe start at the top, that's easier, and work your way down and see what you can prioritize there with your vote. It really helps us a lot. Right, so let's head over to Letizia. Letizia Sedou has been working since 2016 as a EU project manager at the European Network Against Arms Trade. Letizia has an extensive experience in EU level advocacy on peace, human rights, and democracy issues, including 8 years at the World Organization Against Torture Brussels office. She also worked at the EU Civil Society Contact Group and Plan Europe. She holds three master's degrees, which I only have one, so three is pretty cool, in contemporary history, European policy, and human rights. Letizia, great to have you.
Thank you very much, Maximilian. Good evening, everyone. Thanks a lot for organizing indeed an important debate, but also for inviting a kind of more critical voice, because truth is that it's quite rare that this kind of debate with the different point of view happens, unfortunately. I'd like first to remind, especially as a peace group, that there are two levels of debates. One level, I would qualify it more as an ethical or philosophical. Do we need defense? Do we need armed forces? Or how do we want to resolve conflict? It's not the debate of today, definitely, so I'm not going to enter into that. But I think it was important to remind that this should be the general frame, because this debate is always evacuated. In peacetime, because we don't feel we need it, especially in the West, because we are still part of it of the dominant world, so we don't think about the wars still happening somewhere else. And in wartime, we always say that it's not the right time to do it. So in the end, we never do that conversation. And it's a problem also because having this wider ethical frame is the one who should be guiding. It should be the frame under which we can start discussing the second level of debate we are having today. Because that should be a bit kind of giving a vision where we want to go. So the debate now is more about, okay, what is needed for a European defense? I think many things have been already said, which shows that a huge first problem is the lack of clarity and of vision of where we want to go, what this European defense should look like, concretely speaking. And I think this lack of clarity, for example, about EU army or not EU army, role of national armies, replacements, who commands, who decide about peace and war, what is the role of the parliament, et cetera, et cetera. These are key questions of where we want to go. This lack of clarity, I think, is partly intentional, because this absence of clear message makes it very easy to claim that there is a wide consensus for having a European defense. But truth is that you have probably as many visions of what this should look like as you have actors involved in it. But then, because you avoid the debate, you can claim you grow on. The main consequence, I think, of that, which is very problematic, is that we don't know where we go, meaning we are sure we arrive nowhere. And the consequence is that, but then the concrete policies that do happen, we do have a European Defence Fund for research and military development, we have EU funding for boosting production, we have the funds that Hannah has been mentioning for procurement, et cetera, et cetera. We have more and more of those funds. In fact, they are limited to mainly the lowest common denominator or the easy hanging fruit, which is to subsidize the arms industry, to endlessly increase military spending both at national and European level, and to produce more and more weaponry, and to feed the global arms race. And maybe the first question we could have is that really a solution against Russia, for example, if we take that scenario? And my point is not about dismissing the danger or the threat and what is happening in Russia, of course, in Ukraine, sorry, the Russian invasion in Ukraine. But still there are data by independent sources, if I can say so, not peace groups necessarily, about our military spending still being double and from the one of Russia. And even in previous years, for the last 20 years, it has been sometimes 4 or 5 more than the Russian military spending. The second point, and it's a source from the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, who's been comparing the military capabilities between Europe, US, and Russia, and the general conclusion, and I invite people to go and look at that, is that we are not that bad. I mean, we are usually doing as much as Russia in terms of soldiers, quantity of weapons, et cetera, et cetera. It's not that we have huge gaps. Which leads me to one question. Is putting more money and building more weaponry just a solution? Or is not the problem lying somewhere else? I'm not saying that there is not a problem, but I'm questioning the fact that just putting more money will be the solution. Maybe the solution is more about who is going to decide, who is the commander, who is commanding in a situation like that. So that's the first, I think, important point, whether the term will be efficiency of what we are doing. Another important element, of course, is that we don't have a commissioner for peace, of course, and for human security. But we don't even have a European commissioner for defense, contrary to what is labeled for Mr. Kubilius, which is presented as commissioner for defense. Concretely speaking, he's a commissioner for the defense industry. There is a DG, a Directorate General DEFI. It's for defense industry and space. That's unique in EU policies. You have a health policy at European level, you have a commissioner for health and a director general for health, not for the pharmaceutical industry. This also means that under health policy, you have a formal and structured dialogue with civil society, with non-profit actors, with NGOs active on the health sector. There is nothing like that under the defense policies being developed by the European Commission. They are mainly under a very influence of the arms industry, presenting its interests, feeding into the proposals put on the table at a very early stage, before they are even put on the table. And there is nothing to bring a different vision and to enlarge the discussion, not in the Commission definitely, but not really even happening in the European Parliament, to be honest. We are not, peace groups are not considered as relevant interlocutors. So that leads me to a third major concern. The fact that those policies are largely aimed at boosting the global competitiveness of the arms industry, because this is where the European Commission has a competence. That's what they can do. They cannot work on the other aspects. So quickly speaking, this has consequences, in particular regarding ethical issues. And I think it's a very important point also that has been largely overlooked so far. It's important to remind that an important focus of the EU defense policies that we call military policies are about supporting the arms industry into research and development of new weaponry, of the next generation of weaponry, of disruptive technologies that will radically change the way to conduct wars. So think about artificial intelligence, unmanned systems, etc., etc. Yet the ethical assessments and ethical framework for those projects in order to check safeguards, to anticipate risks for civilians, to make sure to respect international law when developing and using it, are really falling short of the minimum standards. And it's not only peace groups saying so, it's also the European Ombudsman. First, the ethical assessments of the research and development project for new weaponry, they are largely based on the self-assessments by the applicants themselves, kind of being both church and parties. Second, the list of experts to assist the Commission is not made public. So there is no way to check possible conflicts of interest. And this has been clearly labeled as a problem by the European Ombudsman. And third, the Ombudsman itself qualified the ethical checks in the first programs for research and development in the military area. He they it qualified it as ticking box exercise. We could not access the document, but the ombudsman could, and that's the conclusion she took. And because there is no transparency, there is no way to know if this has improved in the follow-up programs, in the new programs that are now running. Not the civil society, but not even the European Parliament have access to sufficiently tools and sufficient information to make a proper independent assessment of what is the Commission is doing with those programs and what those programs are leading us to. So to a certain extent, we are asked to blindly trust the European Commission and the arms industry as implementer of the projects. And this issue of transparency is not only for the peace facility, which is a kind of special program, not so much where the parliament does not have a lot of say on it. The parliament itself has accepted that the transparency was limited. The parliament itself has accepted to not be able to play its normal oversight role. In the EU, in European programs, usually the parliament can check every year, let's say, the work program, have a bit of a say on how the programs are being implemented. This was taken out from the parliament, but with the agreement of the parliament since 2017. So that means that for almost 10 years now, the parliament each time is accepting not to have its normal oversight and control role on defense policy. So to a certain extent, it's even losing credibility on the matter. And then another, of course, key ethical issue I want to raise from our point of view is the issue of the arms exports. The arms exports issue is not only for later, for once we would have resolved the situation. It is today, because this pressure, this competitiveness angle, this idea of boosting global competitiveness is pushing for more export. We are going to produce more weapons. We are going to pile them, to stockpile them. What is going to happen if, in particular, if we accept the narrative that this is deterrence? We don't go to war. What do we do with all this weapon we are going to produce, we are going to procure? We see that there is a strong, and I will end up with that, there is a strong pressure on the arms export control system to be loosened and to be weakened. This is happening for exports outside the EU, but this is also happening for arms exports inside the EU. Again, here with not enough critical role, I think, from the European Parliament to denounce the fact that there is a global deregulation process to favor the business of arms within the EU for transfers of weaponry, but also about environmental norms, chemical safeguards, social rights are being undermined to allow, to facilitate the business of arms. And this is really going way beyond providing some form of security. And I will conclude here for the time being.
Thank you so much, Letizia. So it's very clear, and I think that I'm already feeling a very good discussion here. So thank you so much for bringing all that into the discussion. I will finish with our last guest, who will get the last word in our little round of keynotes, and it's Gabrielius Landsbergis. From 2020 to 2024, he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Lithuania. He's a member of the Christian Democratic Party of Lithuania and was its party leader from 2015 to 2024. He's been a member of the Lithuanian Parliament since 2016 until 2024, I think. And prior to that, he was also a member of the European Parliament for 3 years. So a colleague of Hannah's, actually before Hannah came into Parliament. So two MEPs, one former, one current on that panel. And in 2022, Gabrielius received the Ukrainian Order of Merit from Volodymyr Zelensky. And we are really, really honored to have you, Gabrielius, and you have the floor.
Hello, dear Maximilian, dear friends. It's a great honor to be included in the panel. As always, it's a bit more difficult to speak to take the floor last because quite a lot of things have been already said. So I will try to limit myself to to the position of a country that is on the border and closest to where the war and the biggest challenges for Europe is taking place. Whenever we are talking about European security, the changes in geopolitics, the way that Europe should be dealing with it, You know, for somebody from Lithuania or any other eastern flank country, it's much more personal, because whenever we talk about this, if European security is being challenged, practically we almost always know that it most potentially is challenged in one of our countries. You know, to put it very simply, if Russians decide to, you know, to test, you know, whether Europeans are ready to defend European continent, well, there are only so many countries where they would do that. In order to, you know, to make this point even, you know, closer to home, when we talk about so-called hybrid activities, you know, arson attempts, you know, cable cuttings and stuff like that, you know, also the countries closest to Russia are firstly being challenged. And, you know, among those is my country. So I would like to paint a little bit the situation where I see and where the geopolitical conversation, at least from my perspective, should start and stem from, you know, thinking about the future. So first of all, Europe geopolitically, and I will continue what Camille said, is facing probably the greatest geopolitical challenge since the Second World War. And even though that has been said number of times, I think it's important to understand that and really take it into the heart, that this challenge is not about to go away. And you know, and we can analyze what is the reason. So first of all, Putin's war against Ukraine that started in 2022, it's not about the rights of Russian speakers in Ukraine. It's not about, you know, he's not about to stop when he has some, you know, few villages or few more meters of Ukrainian soil. It's the war of imperial conquest that is meant to bring Russia back to a great European continental powers table. I think it's fair to say that Putin does understand that he is unable to present himself as a global power. He's losing Syria. He's most likely losing Iran. He just lost Venezuela, and so basically all the premonitions of Russia's global extent is basically gone and evaporated. But he has an ability to put himself as equal to the countries like Germany, like France, like United Kingdom, and basically rearrange European security architecture in more into his image. And I think that this is what he's. What he's seeking. Tactically, Putin believes that the time is rather beneficial to him. The war of attrition. So basically, every day when we, you know, when we see news and we hear that, you know, that Russia was able just to get a couple more meters, you know, at enormous expense of manpower, you know, kind of it doesn't seem much, and we might start to think that, well, maybe it's impossible for Russia to, you know, to go ahead. But I don't believe that this is Russia's goal. I, you know, have a strong sense that, you know, when we think about the war of attrition, Putin is thinking that, you know, it will go slow until one day, you know, his opponent, in this case, Ukraine, would just collapse. You know, a country that is smaller, a country that is, you know, weaker, does not have an ability to draw on vast manpower resources, ammunition resources in a way that Russia can. And with the help of China, with the help of North Korea, with the help of Iran and other countries that are supporting it, you know, the country would just not be able to sustain defensive objectives. Again, now this winter, we're seeing that even though the front lines are moving very, very slowly, Russia is advancing very slowly. I mean, the barrage of the cities is enormous. You know, Kiev is deserted, and you know, people are unable to live in the, you know, cold houses, cold apartment buildings, just because there is no heating and no electricity. So Putin's hope is that one day, basically, you know, that will just Ukraine would be unable to, you know, to continue. And then for that, you know, kind of he can envisage, you know, that, you know, it might take 2 years, it might take 5 years, who knows how long, but I mean he's able to continue. But on the other hand, there are a couple of things that, you know, where time works against Putin, and we have to keep that in mind. Even though Russia is anything, you know, is very, very far from democracy, still a leader needs a, you know, what we would call a mandate. Basically, something that would stem down the revolutions, either in his inner circle, by the people who are supporting him, or by the wider society. So where does Putin's mandate come from? My thinking is that he... basically, there are a couple elements that produce his mandate. One is so that the societies, the major societies in the big cities of Russia, such as Moscow, St. Petersburg, Yekaterinburg, are not touched by the war. So first of all, that the kids are not being sent over to the front, they are not dying, at least not in the numbers that would, you know, be unsustainable for the parents and kind of for the society, so that they would all know that somebody has died. So, so Putin is solving that by sending minorities, involving people from the global partner countries. You know, we constantly hear reports about, you know, one or another African country that comes out and says that, you know, that we've been deceived, our people are being drawn into the war. Secondly, in this regard, people need to be able to sustain their lives economically. You know, I would put it very bluntly, you know, if I'm able to procure an iPhone, an Android phone in the shop, I kind of think that the life is normal. And this is what Putin wants to maintain, the level of normality. And again, the reports from Moscow are, you know, are pretty much painting this picture, that the life is rather normal, even though the war has entered, you know, is ending a fourth year and will soon start a fifth year. So that is one thing. If Putin is on, you know, kind of, this situation is not changed, you know, he believes that he can be fine. The second thing is that at least his circle wants to have victories. He has to produce the imperial grandiosity of a country. You know, with a very fast war in Georgia, 2008, then Syria, you know, 2014, Ukraine. Basically, he's shown that the West is weak, militarily unable to defend the partners that we've chosen, such as Georgia and Ukraine. And Russia is able to rectify the mistakes, or what he called the greatest geopolitical mistakes of 20th century, i.e. the fall of the Soviet Union. But he needs to continue with the victories in order to maintain his mandate. So one of my beliefs is that Europe is caught in the catch where if Putin is successful in Ukraine, he will be pushed to continue his military effort. But even if he's stuck in Ukraine, the push for victories might force him to escalate horizontally in order to produce military, you know, victories for his environment. Therefore, you know, there is no easy way for Europe to get out of this issue. Europe will have to figure out the way how to defend itself militarily. And here, it is obvious that for decades, Europe has based its defense on a single most important factor: our transatlantic partnership. Which, unfortunately, we have to admit that it's changing in nature, and changing in nature quite radically. Again, you know, one of the pitfalls for European thinking is that the situation might change with either midterm elections that are coming next year, or, you know, with a re-election of a democratic president, maybe after the next presidential election. Again, why I'm calling this a pitfall, because I don't think that this is due to just to President Trump's policies or his administration policies. The United States is in the episode of his pessimistic geopolitical outlook. The general thinking in United States is that United States is losing the war against China, and European theater, transatlantic theater, distracts it from the main problem, which is China. And then when we ask the question about, you know, about the European ability to defend itself, almost no American, you know, American thinker, NGO, or academia would tell that they're, you know, either on right or left side, they would tell that Europe is unable to defend itself, meaning that, you know, Europeans have to defend themselves in the eyes of American people on the both sides of the political spectrum. So that means that whatever is happening after the midterms of a next presidential election, most likely United States will remain indifferent or different towards its attitude to European security. Now the main question is, you know, I've long advocated for, you know, for the point, and, you know, other Pelagians on the panel are saying this, that Europe needs to step up. That's obvious. But the main question here, can Europe step up? The way that Europe currently is set up, the democratic institutions, and one of the questions was that I received was, you know, how to make it more democratic. I think that Europe is so democratic that basically we are, you know, of what the, you know, Tocqueville called the tyranny of the minority. You know, you can have a one voice in the European councils, you know, Viktor Orban, and basically any decision is cancelled and unable to make. So is Europe able at the time of crisis to make strategic decisions that are required? And unfortunately, I don't think that it can. Therefore, we have to think about other ways, how in short term Europe should be able to defend itself better. And at least, again, coming back to, you know, to my country, to Lithuania, what we are seeing, and probably one of the most standout symbols of, you know, a new thinking in the European security is the, you know, what we call the Lithuanian Brigade, or in our case, it's a German brigade that is supposed to arrive to Lithuania in 2027. It's a more of a bilateral regional arrangement that would allow to sustain and deter. Sustain the security environment and deter any Russian attempts to change it in the short to midterm. I would assume that if the European inability to make strategic decisions when it comes to more defense allocations, you know, different new programs that would help Ukraine or the countries on the front line, Eastern Front, I would believe that we would be seeing more regional arrangements coming up, and mostly in the northern part of Europe. So you would probably see more cooperation between Nordic and Baltic countries, so-called NB8, including Poland into that, including Germany into that, and, well, basically in the form of a coalition of the willing, where France could contribute, where United Kingdom could contribute. The biggest problem here, probably, you know, it's easy to mention that might lead to what you could call the European fractures. But unfortunately, as I try to, you know, to relay that the geopolitical risks are real, they unfortunately are not just political. And, you know, in some cases, we believe that they're existential. That means that the politicians are pushed to find solutions today, and we cannot wait for another, you know, European Council to meet. Another meeting, you know, or, you know, God forbid, a referendum or something like that, that if that would be required. We need to have solutions now because the Russian threat is not going away. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much, all. This was really, this is really need to re-listen to it, and I think a lot of people will. And now we do have half an hour now for Q&A and questions. And I want to start off before going a bit through the list of questions. I want to start off with one question that that comes up in the Q&A quite a lot, and you've also mentioned in different ways in all your keynotes. And this is the question about, you know, what does it really need for Europe to really work together and not only do kind of national and binational, trinational things? And I think, you know, Leticia formulated it in a way that, you know, there is maybe also lack of clarity where to go. And I know that, Gabrielius, you have called in a piece last year for a European doctrine. So in a way to, you know, that not 27 member states have different defense goals, but maybe we start to align in Europe on a common goal. So I wondered, and I want to do the table here, how do we get Europe to work better together on that? Do you agree with Gabrielius in a way that he said, you know, we're going to have more fractured, more coalition of the willing, or is there maybe a way by having more clarity on the way to go to unite more European countries together? And I'm going to do the round as we did at the beginning, and then we're going to go in the written question. So, Hannah, how do we get more European countries together, and do we need more clarity on actually where to go?
I think, okay, I wanted to start by saying we have clarity on what the challenges are, but we still have a bit of an east, northeast, southwest divide, I would say a bit. And that's, of course, one of the problems where it starts. So there are countries such as Lithuania, where Gabrielos is from. Let's say all the Baltic countries, everybody who's close to Ukraine or the Russian borders, they understand very well the aggression and the problem. And also they have, I mean, some historical experiences with the Russians that are deeply entrenched, I think, in cultural memory. And then we have other countries, namely Portugal and Spain, to some degree, but also France, and then Germany is a bit in the middle. But especially, let's say, the southern ones that look more towards the Mediterranean as a source of security or insecurity. And of course, they have a bit of a different perspective. So one of the problem already starts with, let's say, a joint threat perception. Do we see the same threats and do we rank them the same way? And on this one, we are not on the same page. Then we also have this, and that's something, I mean, I'm 41, that I really don't understand, this very deeply national defense cultures. So it's like the one thing, defense and my army and my defense and my country, and I need to defend it, that in some countries, especially France, maybe Kabi can say something about that, but also Germany, so the big ones, is deeply, deeply entrenched. So even the Germans, when they wrote their defense industry strategy last year, they still insisted that basically Germany needs to be able to produce all the key capabilities themselves. They are far away from being able to do that, but that's the goal. It's the same with the force de frappe with the French. And then we have some smaller member states that don't even own everything. So not every Baltic country has fighter jets. The Dutch don't even have their own army independent of co-battalions with other countries. So that's also a very big difference between those that still have the idea that they can do everything by their own. I mean, the idea in the sense of the illusion. And those that know they are heavily dependent and they might be left out if we kind of renationalize things. That doesn't make things easier. But it's highly frustrating that we don't move beyond that. And it's, again, going back to my entry statement, how many more wake-up calls do we need to move beyond that? Because like that, we will never, ever be able to defend Europe. And we had, I think it was about a year ago, when we had these tiny Russian provocations when they flew into airspace, Polish airspace, in the Baltic countries in the airspace. And for me, it is totally clear. If Russia attacks one country in the European Union, it's an attack to the European Union, and we have to defend the European Union as the European Union, because otherwise the European project is dead. And if you take that perspective, none of that nitty-gritty national level discussion makes any sense. How can we move beyond that? Yeah, that's the big challenge I'm looking at all the time. I have this, you know, because I just redid it. So every 6 months, there's a new council presidency. So a new member state takes over the role of kind of leading the council of member states. And whenever that is, the ministers come to the relevant committees and the heads of states come to the plenary and they announce what they want to do. And I'm playing this game now for the 6.5 years that I'm in European Parliament, because everybody comes and speaks of, we want a European defense union, or we want strategic autonomy, or we want a truly European defense. So they have different wordings, but they always want that. And it's key of their working program. And every time I say, okay, and I totally get you, and you may be surprised, the Greens are all on your side. Would you mind telling us which concrete competences you are willing to transfer from the national to the European level so that we can walk, let's say, first little steps. I'm not saying European army. I'm just saying walk first little steps towards a European approach to that. And there has always been, no matter which country, absolute silence on this question. And that is the key of the problem. They speak European, they act national, and it is very difficult to build a good foreign and defense policy on that.
Thank you. So, Camille, what do you think? So what is the way to get European countries there closer together of the things and the possibilities we heard?
First of all, we have to recognize that we have a sort of long history. You know, the efforts to build a European defense architecture go back to the late 1940s, and there's been multiple attempts, often running into national policies, because defense is perceived by most of our member states as a as a sort of national prerogative that is, and it has been very, very difficult. So whether it was the European defense community in the 1950s, whether it's multiple efforts to build the Western European Union, which was a 1948 treaty, into something that would mean a more unified and independent Europe, whether it's the current efforts of the last 20 years to build an EU that is acting on defense. And that has always run into what Anna described very well, which is this response by the member states, which is to say, well, I am solely responsible for my defense policy. I work in the NATO framework, but the NATO framework is that of a purely intergovernmental framework, and I'm not comfortable with a more unified EU approach to things. On top of that, there are ups and downs in defense cooperation. So there were moments, and there were some very, very successful programs that we've seen in the past. You know, for instance, in the domain of missiles, we have essentially one big European champion with MBDA and a few others that are quite present. But ultimately, they are some of the most advanced weapon systems that were developed jointly. By this, the Airbus is a multinational construct and is perceived as such, even though it's often criticized as too French in Germany, too German in French, and too Franco-German elsewhere. So it's creating problems. But at the end of the day, I guess to answer your challenge and also bear in mind what is there. I think at the moment, we need to be flexible. What I mean by this is we need to be capable of building the coalitions of the willing where possible and where it's needed. So to get the countries that are the most willing to work together on a given project, to work together on a given mission, and to move faster than others there. And we have to recognize that some sort of a flexibility, especially when it comes to complex projects, it might be needed. On the other hand, we also have to recognize that the EU has become, even if some member states don't like it, a player in the domain. It is not a big spender, and that, you know, fair to recognize that what the EU spends, what the Commission spends, what the European Parliament oversees is roughly 2% of defense spending in Europe. So it's not as if it were, you know, that gigantic pot of money, but still, and possibly under the next multi-annual financial framework, it would be more than that, you know, moving to closer to 5%, let's say. So what would that mean in the real world? And there, I think we have to recognize that the EU does exist, that the EU should be given the tools to run those projects, and needs to build, and this is something that is currently lacking in my view, a proper governance for that, where the Commission can work with the member states and, you know, sort of recognize that we are in a sort of bizarre environment with defense, which is not strictly speaking the civilian environment, but where the EU can make a difference. And so that is there. And finally, you know, it is true that most of the money will continue to be spent domestically and nationally. The issue is, where do we move that? And to move that, I think that one of the ideas to allow multiple forms of cooperation. In some instances, it will be more of a sort of lead nation concept, where you have a big country that brings others on board in the joint procurement. In others, it will be something which will be built around an EU original project. I strongly believe that for the most complex projects, the Europeans need to act together. You know, the reality of small and big states in Europe. You know, there's Paul-Henri Spaak, the Belgian foreign minister of the 1950s, said in Europe there are not small and big states, there are small states, and there are small states that have not yet understood that they were small states. France and Germany are small states to a degree, and this is, you know, we have to recognize that. It doesn't mean that we are not serious, that we don't matter, but it means that we have to recognize that working with others is useful.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a bit, I mean, when you say that about small states, I just remembered Mark Carney's speech in Davos in a way, because he said exactly that, right? So we need to an alliance of the middle states, of the middle nations in that geopolitical world. So Letizia, you brought it up in a way, you know, that there is no clear direction, that there is no, you know, where do we want to be? So are you convinced by what you have heard? Do you now see that, is there some clarity for you? Or if not, you know, from the view of civil society, what should the aim actually be?
Thanks. I don't really see more clarity in the sense that, as I said before, we need a purpose. We need to know where we want to go. The military tool, whether it's industry or armed forces, should be only one mean among many others for a broader purpose. And this, we don't have it. And I think we should not, I mean, I fully agree with what Hannah said about its national interest, but it's not only political or related to sovereignty, it's also related to the national industrial interest. And maybe also one way to get out of it is to stop putting the arms industry at the core center of everything, because there you have also big interests that are competing, and countries don't want to give up on that. So maybe we should just also try to get away of that pure perspective. And we need political courage, in particular from the parliament, because the alternative we have to member states not playing by the rules of the European game, and Anna said it very, very well, they want the money, but they don't want to apply by the rules. But the problem is that the parliament is letting them do. That's a key issue. The only pure democratic body we have at the EU level is the European Parliament. And that's where we are drastically lacking sufficient dialogue with critical voices. And at the end of the day, a vast majority of MEPs are voting for all these measures that are proposed, including with all the ethical shortfalls, lack of democratic control, lack of transparency. So they lose credibility on the debate. It appears like a rubber stamp chamber. And I think it's very important, because if we have this critical voice at the European Parliament, that will allow also for a stronger public debate. Because I think that at the end of the day, the ones who have to make the decision are the citizens. They need to be much more involved in it. But for that, we need good dialogue, good debate, critical debate, an enlarged debate about what we want to do in the end, you know, how Europe wants to be an actor in the world to resolve conflict in a different way than with armed force. It doesn't mean that we have to get rid of all weapons from day to night, but we need to put them at their place, which is one tool among many others. And here we see the contrary, that all means and all focus is put on the military force and on the arms industry, on rearmament, and the other tools are completely left out of the scope and with reduced resources.
Thank you. And I'm getting Gabrielis in here before we open for the reading of the Q&A. So you opened that Pandora's box a bit, I would say, with claiming that, you know, one sign of the European Union to be too democratic is the actual veto power in the council, which I found funny, because actually for me that is one of the signs of Europe not being democratic at all, because a veto has very little to do with actually democracy, I would argue. It's quite the opposite of it. And so I wondered actually, you know, in terms of you know, you've been a member of the European Parliament, a member of the Lithuanian Parliament, as you've been a party leader. So how do you see the role of parliaments, both in your own country, but also on the European level? So do you see some merit in what Hannah and Letizia said, that we need to strengthen the role of parliaments?
Well, I specifically, you know, provoked, but I used, you know, Tocqueville's phrase where, you know, where he says that democracy becomes not a democracy when, you know, when it is under the oppression of a minority. So this is basically, you know, this is what I was trying to say, that basically, you know, while trying to be as democratic as possible, we reach the point where we are becoming ineffective and unable to make any decision. So this is where Europe finds itself at. You know, any conversation about the role of European Parliament, you know, is needed, and you know, how can we strengthen it? And unfortunately, I mean, if we approach the question of how institutions work and how the power is divided in European Union, I have a strong sense that without a change of treaties, it is impossible to, you know, to approach the question. And therefore, of course, I am a proponent of reviewing the treaties and going the lengthy process. But I mean, you know, I don't see many optimists about, you know, how to deal with that. Now, when it comes to the national parliaments and the dialogue between the, you know, between the citizens and the decision makers, I would say that the one of the biggest problem is naming the problem. And I believe that even if I would say that this is one of the issues that we have in my country, I believe that it's probably elsewhere as well. In a way that the politicians are not eager to be publicly explicit about how big the problem we are facing. You know, we don't want to scare our electorate. We don't want to be, you know, we don't want to scare the investors, and that's why we keep it, you know, lower and don't say what it is. And then we shouldn't be surprised that the politicians do not have a mandate for wide sweeping reforms, for you know, more defense spending, or the, you know, anything that needs to happen. So I always advocated that first step is to be open with a society and to really tell it as it is.
Thank you. All right. So let's start into the questions. We have a question I actually didn't expect really as the first question, but still very, very, very exciting question from Heiko Prendl, got like more than 60 votes. He asked the current German, and he said, puts German in brackets here, I would say it's also a bigger one, of a European security strategy sidesteps the question of strategic nuclear deterrence. There are good reasons for this, in brackets, military, financial, international law. What is your assessment? Will EU have or need to have its own nuclear capabilities in 10 or 20 years? And we're going to do this, answering those questions. Not every one of you has to answer that question, because otherwise we won't get through. So volunteers are welcome. You can use the hand button as well, or you just show up and wave if you want to answer the question. So I saw a hand from Camille, and then if anyone else wants to add, then happy to.
I think we can have a fairly straightforward answer to that. First of all, there are, in the German case, there are a number of legal impediment, not only the membership of the non-proliferation treaty, but also the unification treaty, which makes things, you know, any decision on ongoing nuclear extraordinarily complicated. Plus, of course, a public opinion that I don't think has, and I'm speaking under Anna's control here, but I don't think there is a strong push from the public for that in any case. So I think the fact that the debate is happening signals that in certain corners of the German political and academic debate, just signals the fact that we have entered a moment that we all described, which is very, very different. And therefore, there is a tendency to sort of reopen old debates. You know, and there was such a debate in Germany in the 1960s. To see what would be the right answer. And I think at the moment what's complicated is that the German debate is a bit struggling, because the traditional answer, which was NATO nuclear sharing arrangement, is questioned by the US behavior, not so much than the rest, because the Americans have not signaled any intention to withdraw their nuclear support, but I mean, for the bigger picture. The notion of a euro bomb has no traction in anywhere. In fact, you know, it's a very and the EU is not going to go nuclear. I don't think that will ever happen as an organization. And the conversation with the French and the Brits is complicated. So that puts a thing there. But I think what it signals, and I'll end on this, is a need to have a much more honest nuclear conversation in Europe on what is needed, where are the Americans, where are the French, where are the Brits, and what can the non-nuclear countries do short of becoming nuclear themselves as part of this for deterrence. Are there tools such as missile defense, conventional strike capabilities that offer useful additions to the portfolio of deterrence measures short of going nuclear, which to me will remain extraordinarily complicated, not only for legal reasons, but also for all sorts of political reasons. So I leave it at that for the moment, as a sort of an analytical standpoint, but I'm happy to be corrected on this one.
Any additions? Oh, we're going to go on. So then we're going to go on if nobody speaks up. We have a second question, which actually interesting that it comes after that nuclear first one. That is, does the EU need to adopt a more imperialistic stance in order to assert its interest against Russia, China, and yes, even the US? Or is the EU's current approach to foreign and foreign trade policy still appropriate in a world increasingly dominated by aggressive partners? So the question is, does the European Union become more imperialistic, maybe call it have a more robust foreign policy, that by the example of Russia and China here? So that's an interesting question, I would say, for Hannah.
I'm happy to take that. I would challenge the word imperialistic as the way to go. But I indeed think we should become more proactive, more engaged, because there is a big gap. So there are a lot of countries that are not necessarily brilliant democracies, but that really have the same interest that we have in upholding the international order as something where we deal with each other based on rules, and on treating each other fairly and with respect and benefiting from also global trade. And they are also a bit frustrated, puzzled, looking for other partners. And the European Union, if we step up to that and we offer them some things like free trade agreements, like a closer cooperation, then I think we could be quite attractive to create an alternative model to, let's say, either the Russian, the Chinese, or this new weird American one that I'm still lacking the words, but this clearly means that we have to become also a bit more pragmatic in this kind of cooperation. So in the world as of today, if we want to safeguard the idea of an international rules-based legal order and of respect and free trade, then we will have to work with partners that have been more difficult for us to work with in the past.
Thank you very much.
That includes implementing Mercosur and reaching out to India, by the way, if somebody was waiting for that answer.
We're not going to go into Mercosur today. We had that last week already. So, Letizia, even though it's an important question, but Letizia.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think it's a key point. In fact, for me, it's a very important question. And I think that Europe and the EU is already imperialist. We don't like to see it. We want to see that, but that's a reality. And not only recently, but for decades and centuries. And I know we always say that with Putin, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there is a return of imperialism. I think this is a wrong analysis, because for a return, we need first a departure. And there was no departure of imperialism. When the Soviet Union collapsed, we had an over dominant imperialism, which was the Western one, where you could put US and Europe together. As Europeans, we hide always behind the American imperialism, but we are part of it. It's even a creation of us, historically speaking, to a certain extent. So we never stop being imperialists, unfortunately. And I think that's part of why we are where we are. And I also think that a large motivation behind the rearmament processes is about defending and maintaining European imperialism. If you look at the White Paper for Defense published in March, it's very interesting, because it's quite clear, you know, that they really clearly mention that we need military power in order to maintain, to keep up the race against our competitors. And they mean China and the US, and the right it so. They don't say Russia. In terms of economic and technological race, we are competing not with Russia, but with China and with the US. So I unfortunately think that behind this militarization process and these rearmament policies, we do have a fight about who is going to be imperialist and who is going to have his share of the cake. And to a certain extent, the rivalry is about, okay, is it China and Russia or is it US and Europe? But we do are already imperialist, and I think that's what is leading us to those conflicts and those tensions.
Very interesting. Thank you. Wanna go into, well, maybe we can manage two more questions. And one is actually the next one on the list is something that's resonating many other questions. And it's actually is the use of Palantir, so one of the surveillance softwares from the US, or a suite of surveillance softwares. We actually did a very big webinar on this last year, if you wanna look into it. So is Palantir's use in Europe being considered as a security threat, given it's a US company? And I want to add another question to it. So can we make sure that we not only buy European defense techs, so like Swedish fighter jets instead of American ones, and no Palantir? And for me, that's, you know, Palantir is now used by ICE to find migrants. They're going to hunt on the streets of Minnesota or anything like that. So, you know, this is obviously kind of the jury is very much out of on that company. So I wanted to take Aprilius in here, because for me, that's opening up a bigger question about, you know, also hybrid warfare, as Hannah put it, and you as well. So how do we deal with those challenges? And you know, when we consider using such a tool, and Germany has introduced it, for example, I'm not sure about Lithuania, those kind of tools where we don't have the end control over F-35 jets is a similar story, right? So do you agree with Hannah when she said, you know, we have not yet this complete holistic view? And how do you see that, especially on the tech sovereignty side of things?
Well, thank you for the question. You know, I believe that it starts with the money and with our, you know, and our signaling to the defense sector and to the, you know, tech sector, European tech sector, that we are ready to, you know, to spend what we promised. You know, I've been in contact when the war started, after the war started in 2022, with number of, you know, Western European defense companies. And the main message that has always, you know, been relayed to me, then part of the government, was that, look, we don't trust that you are going to spend what you're telling that you're going to spend. You know, you're talking about the percentages, but, you know, but nobody knows for sure how long that's going to be. So same thing, you know, look, so even Lithuania now, take my country. So this year, yes, indeed, we increased, you know, the spending enormously. It's more than 5% of our GDP, 5.3% of our GDP spent on defense. But if you ask the, you know, the producers in Lithuania, they would say, well, I mean, is it sustainable? Is it going to last? Is it going to be next year the same thing? If it's not, then I'm not going to, you know, to build another factory. Then I'm not going to invest into some technology, you know, produce some application that would, you know, that would require a very significant investment. So that is the, you know, one of the biggest problems. So if that is about to change, if we manage, you know, and this is where the European funding is enormously beneficial, because, you know, European planning, European money can be planned ahead, and it's an enormous investment amount of investment. That can send the message to the producers that, look, the things are changing. There are positive signs in this, and of course it starts with the, you know, hard stuff, such as, you know, Rheinmetall, you know, now issuing a statement that they are going to produce 1.5 million shells, ammunition shells a year, which is more than the production capacity of the United States. So why is it coming from? It's not just from the risk assessment, but it's basically from the funding that, you know, the German government has decided, with the approval of German parliament, to, you know, to spend an enormous amount on defense. And this is, you know, that allows the defense companies to do that. So if we want a change, if we want a European, you know, companies producing technologies to compete with Palantir and others, we have to make sure that we put a lot of, you know, sustainable long-term funding on the table that would allow the companies to plan.
Thank you very much. I want to actually try to close on this, but want to get the other three in for a very quick last word on that, because I think that's, you know, I want to combine two things. And I wondered, Camille, if you if you agree with that assessment, that, you know, what in Germany is called Planungssicherheit, so like, you know, the secure planning and, you know, some outlook there, is that was preventing Europe also from producing this? And wouldn't, for example, be a bit more transparency and democratic control actually alleviate that? Because, you know, once the parliament as the legislator has maybe voted on this and has been a discussion, that could actually also then improve credibility and, you know, security of those kind of decisions.
No, but I think that there are two issues in the question that was put to us. I mean, on a company like Palantir, Palantir is amongst the new defense tech company, one of the one that has driven the most the biggest debates because of its role in investing in internal security tools, and therefore, you know, also the role of Peter Thiel in the early days of the company and things like that. So it is a company that creates more controversy than others in the domain from that perspective. When it comes to the, you know, Europe, so, and I think it is one case that makes the, you know, very strong case for digital sovereignty and the sovereignty on our digital tools in Europe. You probably don't want to rely on Chinese face recognition technology or anything of the sort for security or defense. Having said this, I think there is so it really makes the case for being more sovereign on technology and on digital technology in particular. Then the second thing is, in terms of oversight, I think in the European context, and having been both on the side of the government, the side of, you know, the think tank world, and the, you know, we have an enormous oversight happening, and it's parliaments, mostly the national parliaments, because indeed the role of the European Parliament is more limited on defense. The national parliaments have a very, very strong oversight on defense policy and the acquisition. They look into the decisions made by the governments. So I'm not extremely, honestly, I'm not worried, or I've never been worried that the deployment of weapon systems that would be unethical, because I think there is very, very strong oversight there. There can be a debate, and there is a very open debate with the civil society that I've seen when it comes, for instance, to use of unmanned systems. There was a huge debate of the use of controversial systems, and it's been an ongoing conversation, and that is a very democratic conversation.
All right, thank you. We're going to have Letizia, Hannah, and then we close.
Thank you. I mean, there are many things, and I'm not necessarily addressing all that. The two things I'm thinking about this last point that were raised is first that the arms industry is becoming increasingly internationalized. That's something we need to keep in mind. So what we call European companies or EU-based companies, it's also getting more and more complicated to know, because you have a number of companies that are being bought by other, you know, non-EU companies. You have this very famous Milrem Robotics, which was a very startup in Estonia, very much put into light as a success story of EU. It has been bought again by the Emirates, for example. You have many Israeli companies buying European companies, for example. You have US companies setting up branches into the EU so they can access EU funding. So I think there also there is something we need to address. It's not that simple, black and white, this is EU, this is not EU. So that's one thing we need to consider if we want to discuss about being really independent and autonomous. We cannot just ignore that until it's too late. The other thing I was thinking is that this issue of the level of spending, of rearmament, how long do we invest? The arms companies, they want to have very long-term visibility. Hannah is saying at some point we need to scale down once we have reached our objective of peace. All this sounds also quite contradictory. And I will have a bit of a provocative conclusion. I wonder whether we peace group are not maybe a bit more realistic. We are usually considered as being naive and dreamers, but I wonder if we are not more realistic because we say that the armed forces and the arms industry must not be such an important tool. because it's so chaotic, it's being internationalized, because it's always up and down, it doesn't really make sense to go this up and down, and maybe it's more realistic to really limit their role and emphasize much more all the other ways to address and resolve conflict.
Thank you, Letizia. Hannah, for the last word, and I'm closing.
Oh my God, now I have a big responsibility. I wanted to pick up on two discussions that I think we had across the different questions. Yes, we need to be able as European Union to defend ourselves if need be, but let's also not underestimate the power we have because of the dependencies that are there. I remember the last Munich Security Conference, where it's supposed to be a transatlantic conference. There was this J.D. Vance speech, this very infamous one. And we started pretty immediately as members of different European national and the European Parliament, the discussion with our US counterparts saying, guys, but then we stop buying US equipment. We're going to stop buying US military things in the medium and longer run. Is that what you want? And they were like, yeah, but we don't want that. And maybe we can find a solution. And it's the same also with the nuclear sharing. I mean, the deterrence also works for the US because they have certain things stationed in the European Union. And if they walk away from it, why should we allow them to station, to let certain things being stationed in the EU? So I think we should use that also to some degree, also as a lever with regards to US, that they are also somehow dependent financially and security-wise on us. Let's just not underestimate that. And at the same time, still continue to close the capability gaps. And the second one, because I mean, that has also been part of it, the title of this webinar on the accountability and transparency. I agree with Gabrielus that we have a problem, but I don't think that our problem is transparency or accountability. Our problem is unanimity and the national peculiarities and the national perks. And that is why I think that is the way to go if we want to have a truly European. Let's not cut down on transparency and accountability, but let's find ways that we move away from this idea that all 27 have always to agree on everything before we can move one single step. Treaty change is going to be a long run, but let's aim high.
Thank you so much. I think that is a very, very good conclusion. We've 7 minutes over time. Sorry for that. Sorry for the interpreter side, but I think it was worth kind of bringing those thoughts together and close on this. So this was a very interesting debate. Thank you all so much for taking the time. We still have 600 people in the room. This is really great. We hit 1,000 during the time. Many more will watch the recording. So thank you very much. Thank you all for taking our guests, for taking the time, for the many questions for our interpreters and cooperation partners. Thank you so much. We'll be back at Europe Calling sometime in February. We don't have a fixed date yet. We have a couple of ideas what we're going to do, but we have one fixed date already. Beginning of March, we're going to talk about the Ukraine and nuclear policy, actually, the situation in the nuclear power plants, especially in Zaporizhia, and what Rosatom is doing there. So very interesting webinar as well. If you're interested in that, make sure to sign up to our emails. We'll get all the information about that. And apart from that, have a very nice evening, stay safe, and meet again soon. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.